Let's hear what it says in the papers now from John S. Doyle.
The main story for the Irish Examiner, the Irish Daily Star and Irish Daily Mirror is what the Examiner's headline calls the Dubai Duo. The Mirror's headline has a less kind name for the two Dublin women who were imprisoned in Mountjoy for refusing to quarantine after arriving back in Ireland from Dubai last Friday. As the papers report, the women have been permitted to leave the prison, but the High Court has ruled that they must quarantine in a hotel and not at home as they had hoped. The papers note that the women, Niamh Mulroney and Kirsty McGrath, are making a constitutional challenge against laws requiring persons to enter mandatory quarantine on their arrival in Ireland from certain countries. The government's hotel quarantine policy is the main front page topic for the Irish Daily Mail. John Drennan writes that ministers Stephen Donnelly and Simon Coveney are at loggerheads over the list of countries that should be attached to the legislation. Leading with the same story, the Irish Times reports that talks to defuse a government row will consider this week an expanded role for quarantining at home and how vaccinations might be used to reduce periods of isolation after travel from certain countries. There's another COVID story in the Independent's lead. Catherine Donnelly writes that furious teachers are likely to ballot for industrial action unless the government reverses the decision to push them down the vaccine list. Last week's decision has put vaccinations on the agenda of the annual conferences of the three teacher unions, which start tomorrow, she writes. The Irish Sun reports that a survey it carried out shows that one third of TDs and senators are open to ditching the tricolour and national anthem as parts of efforts to unite Ireland. 63 public representatives responded, and one TD, the Independent Michael McNamara, is quoted as saying, "No problem with the new anthem, possibly to the air of Danny Boy." The Irish News reports that Sinn Féin has blamed unionist leaders for a wave of violence in loyalist areas across the north over the Easter weekend. The Belfast Telegraph reports Mark Lindsay, chairman of the Police Federation for Northern Ireland, as saying that police officers were paying the price for a lack of leadership across society there. The Examiner has a long article by Dean Venables promoting the idea of a 45-kilometre greenway in Cork from Lee to Sea, inspired by the High Line walkway along an old railway in New York City. The front-page photograph in The Examiner by Sean Molloy shows Father Gerard Quirk saying Mass at dawn on Easter Sunday at the old Mass Rock at Keem Bay, Achill Island. In the Times, Father Quirk is quoted as saying that on Easter Sunday, Catholics celebrate Jesus emerging from his tomb alive. Roman soldiers covered Jesus' tomb with a stone. We are experiencing that at the moment. Our churches are closed, he said. But Christ was not bound by the stone or the tomb. Cathy Donaghy writes in The Independent about giving up alcohol for Lent. She noticed that her sleep was better, full of dreams, and not interrupted by waking up several times a night. Equally healthy is Larissa Nolan, also writing in The Independent. In January, I started walking an hour every day, she says. I've lost a stone in 2 months, and I cannot believe it turned out to be as simple as putting one foot in front of the other.
John, thank you. The pharmaceutical company GlaxoSmithKline has confirmed that they will not contribute to a redress scheme for mother and baby home survivors. They were asked to take part in the scheme as a result of clinical trials being carried out on children in these homes between 1934 and 1973. Let's talk now to Jack Horgan-Jones, political reporter with the Irish Times. Jack, thanks for joining us. The Commission of Investigation into these mother and baby homes, along with numerous investigative pieces of work by RTE journalists and other journalists on these trials. What's known about what took place in these mother and baby homes?
So the Commission identified 13 separate vaccine trials that took place in different mother and baby homes between 1922 and 1998, as well as clinical trials of non-commercial infant milk products in 1968 and 1969. And when the final report of the Commission of Investigation was published earlier on this year, it effectively found that the consent, the basis on which the the trials were conducted, the informed consent that was obtained either from people responsible for the children involved or from the children involved themselves was not done on a complete basis, and that they were deficient in that regard. Off the basis of that, Roderick O'Gorman last month wrote to GSK, GlaxoSmithKline, saying that survivors, families and supporters of the survivors groups were of the view that reparations should be forthcoming. Now, yesterday, the Sunday Times first reported, and we've been following up on that, saying that the company responded effectively, saying that while they recognise the deficiencies in the design of the trials that were, that took place in the middle of the 20th century, they're of the view that they were effectively done by independent researchers, and therefore GSK itself, as a corporate body, as a corporate entity, isn't in a position to contribute to any redress scheme, which was the ask both of the minister and of the survivors groups.
Right. And these independent researchers, they name them in their letter to the minister. They're all dead at this point in time. They had worked variously for University College Dublin and Trinity College. What else does GlaxoSmithKline say about their reasons for not contributing to the redress scheme?
Yes, as you say, I mean, the researchers who ran the trials themselves are all very eminent paediatricians, public health experts and so on. And GlaxoSmithKline, they do make a rather kind of fulsome profession of regret that their products were involved in these trials. And they also say that they deeply sympathise with all the former residents of the mother and baby homes in Ireland. They extend an olive branch of sorts, saying that they have combed their archives for any information that may be of use to the commission, and they volunteered that, although they do say it was incomplete due to the age of some of the records concerned. And they say that they're hopeful of being able to assist survivors access any records that may relate to them. But that really is as far as it goes in terms of further cooperation. It's cooperation on records, on access to records. It's not cooperation on the redress scheme. So the question, I suppose, is when the company meets, and the company requested a meeting to discuss access to records later this month with Roderick O'Gorman, when that meeting takes place, will the request from the political side, from Roderick O'Gorman, be reiterated again for contribution to that scheme? I would imagine it will be.
Yeah, this programme got a text from the company last night saying that they had agreed to meet with Roderick O'Gorman towards the end of this month. There was no exact date at this point, but can the government do anything but just repeat the request? Can they go any further than that with the company?
I don't believe they have any powers to demand. I don't believe there's any legal basis for them to make a demand that GSK make a contribution to the redress scheme. So it would be very much in the realm of moral suasion or political pressure that they would be looking to bring onto the company. And well, a slightly complicating factor is that while, for want of a better word, third parties have contributed to redress schemes in the past, they've largely been third parties who were more directly involved in the provision of services. You know, there would have been religious orders who contributed to the following in the aftermath of the Ryan Commission, which was published in 2002. So there's not really a direct precedent for someone similar to in a similar role to GSK. The issue of redress is being looked at by a group of senior officials, and they are due to report to the minister by the end of this month. So it will be interesting as well to see whether they address the responsibilities of GSK in this regard, and if any comment is made there, and if that kind of shifts the pitch again.
And do we know, Jack, just finally, how negotiations are going with other institutions when it comes to redress for the mother and baby home survivors?
I didn't quite catch the question, the line dropped out, but I think you're asking about other
redress,
other
yes, negotiations, yeah, with other institutions.
Yeah, I think that's all falling under the heading of what that senior officials group is looking at, and I think it'll be covered by the report, which is due to go to the minister at the end of the month. That's the next kind of staging post in this.
Okay, thank you very much indeed. Jack Horgan-Jones, political reporter with the Irish Times. Two women who refused to go into mandatory hotel quarantine were released from the Dochas Women's Prison in Mountjoy last night after the High Court relaxed their bail conditions. We can hear more now from our reporter who's following this story, Coleman O'Sullivan. Coleman, will you just remind us, first of all, why the women refused to go into quarantine?
Well, we heard from their lawyers over the weekend that the main reason was that they were anxious to get back to their children. They're both lone parents. So in the district court on Saturday, their solicitor, Michael French, told the court that Kirsty McGrath, who is 30 and from St. Anthony's Road in Rialto in Dublin 8, is mother to two young children aged between 6 and 10, and that there's no one else to take care of them. And then yesterday we heard further that her mother had taken leave from her job to look after the two children while Kirsty McGrath had been away, and but she must return to work in the coming days, so obviously there'd be a problem there with childcare. And then Niamh Mulroney, who is 25 and from Scarlett Rowan, Essex Street West in Dublin 2, she's the mother to a 7-year-old child, and she had refused to go into quarantine because she wanted to get home to look after her child. Now the lawyers said both women would agree to bail conditions which would require them to quarantine at home for 2 weeks, and they'd be prepared to do anything to check in with Gardaí, etc., to make sure that they were doing that. But Inspector Luke Lacey at the District Court on Saturday, who objected to bail on behalf of the state, he said that that would make a mockery of the regulations brought in for mandatory quarantine, which were to protect the state from new variants of the coronavirus. And Judge Miriam Walsh at that stage agreed and made hotel quarantine one of the bail conditions. And then yesterday in the High Court, Justice Paul Burns agreed that the hotel quarantine should be part of the bail conditions, although he did reduce the financial requirements of the bail to €100 own bond for each woman.
Why did they go to Dubai?
Well, we were told by their lawyers that they went for cosmetic procedures. And that those cosmetic procedures and the trips had been funded as gifts from family and friends. However, we were also told then yesterday that they didn't undergo those cosmetic procedures in the end when they were in Dubai.
Okay. So, Coleman, where are they now? Are they, and what is happening at the moment?
Well, they have left the Dochas Women's Prison in Mountjoy yesterday evening, where they had been held since Saturday. We don't know for sure, but we understand that as part of their bail conditions, they had to go immediately to a quarantine hotel. In terms of what happens next, they had been challenging the legality of their detention, but now that they've accepted to go into the hotel quarantine as part of their bail conditions, that challenge has now become a constitutional challenge to the legality of the provisions of the Health Act for mandatory hotel quarantine. And that challenge is expected to come before the High Court again later this month.
Okay, Coleman O'Sullivan, many thanks indeed. We're heading north now to find out what last night was like on the streets following two nights of violence in Belfast, Newton Abbey and Derry. Our Northern editor, Vincent Kearney, joins us now. Vincent, was there any trouble last night?
There was indeed, Audrey. There was some trouble in parts of Newton Abbey on the outskirts of Belfast and in Carrickfergus in County Antrim. Now, the police have described this as the violence has been on a sliding scale, if you like. On Friday night in Belfast, there were around 50 to 100 people involved at this height. And the following night on Friday in Newton Abbey, or on Saturday, there was around 30 to 40 people involved in trouble. Last night, the police said the numbers were smaller. It was spread across two areas, Newton Abbey and Carrickfergus. Clearly people still intent on causing injury to police officers because petrol bombs and other missiles were thrown, but the police say certainly the violence was of a lesser degree than it had been on Friday and Saturday.
And who's involved? Because we saw earlier over the weekend that there were very young children, some of them, who were taking part in this.
That's right. Very young people across the board at this stage. Now, on a number of occasions, older men have been seen to be in the area wearing masks, possibly directing some of the activities, but those involved in the violence do appear to be very young people. And that's the one positive, if you like, for the police so far is that profile, because there doesn't seem to be a level of orchestration in that they don't believe mainstream paramilitary organisations are behind this. And there may be elements of paramilitaries involved for their own reasons, but they don't think the mainstream groups are involved, because if they were involved, the numbers in the streets would be much larger, the degree of organisation and organisation would be much greater, and the level of violence would be much more intense.
But is there anyone involved in trying to stop it?
So far, no. It doesn't appear to be. Certainly the politicians across the board are calling for this violence to end, but certainly in those loudest areas there have been older men watching on, and there doesn't appear to have been any attempt to stop this violence. So while the paramilitary organisations as such aren't believed to be behind all of the violence, they don't appear to be stopping it. And there is a difference here, Audrey, in terms of groups as well. Some groups within groups, if you like, have their own reasons for violence. In Newton Abbey in Carrickfergus, for example, a splinter group of the UDA called the South East Antrim UDA is quite strong there. Now, that's a paramilitary organisation really in name only. It is descended into a pure criminal gang, an organised crime gang. They're involved very heavily in drugs, extortion, racketeering, other forms of criminality. The PSNI has been targeting that group, that splinter group, for a couple of years now, and in recent months has scored a number of successes, a number of arrests, a number of drug seizures and seizures of other items and cash. So there is a sense certainly within the police that much of the violence in places like Newton Abbey and Carrickfergus might be a result of that anger from that loyalist faction against the police, rather than part of any widespread political anger, any kind of unrest because of the Northern Ireland Protocol, or any reaction to the decision not to prosecute Sinn Féin members for attending Bobby Storey's funeral last summer. The police view would be some of these elements have been looking for an excuse, if you like, to attack the police, and perhaps are using that decision last week as an excuse in those two areas in particular, Newton Abbey and Carrickfergus.
But we know, Vincent, it doesn't take much for things to kick off. And you mentioned there the prosecutions over the Bobby Storey funeral, none in that regard, the anger over Brexit and the protocol. What's your assessment of just how volatile and tense things are?
Certainly, politically, it's very volatile at the moment. I mean, the power-sharing administration at Stormont, you could never really say, Audrey, is building absolutely solid foundations, but the foundations appear to be a little fragile at the moment. But both of the main parties, the DUP and Sinn Féin, say they're intent in remaining within that power-sharing administration. In terms of violence on the street, there are concerns that coming into the summer months, with COVID restrictions easing, with people coming onto the streets, with this pent-up anger over the protocol, with the political discontent and anger as well, a lot of which unionists would trace back to Bobby Storey's funeral last June. There's an ongoing blame game between the DUP and Sinn Féin as to who's responsible for this. So the political temperature has certainly been raised. But certainly talking to the police, there's no sense here of any appetite for any kind of return to violence across the board. So we have had young people and groups on the streets attacking police officers, but as I say, that hasn't grown into large crowds. It hasn't grown into a major organised act of violence. The police would be concerned that could happen, but at this stage they don't think that there's an appetite for that level of violence.
Okay, well thank you very much, our Northern editor, Vincent Kearney. It is teacher conference season this week, with all the trades unions holding their gatherings virtually this year, and high on their agenda will be how to react to the decision by government to change how the vaccination programme is delivered from one based on occupation to one based on age. The trades union, which represents special needs assistance, will have their educational conference on Friday. We'll hear from Force's Andy Pike in just a moment, but first here's Linda, who works in an ASD unit at a Dublin school working with children aged from 3 to 12. She's been telling our reporter Moira Hannan about what it's like to work in such a role during the pandemic.
Children from the age of 3 to 6, predominantly in my class, which is an ASD classroom for early intervention. So it's hand holding, it's nappy changing, it is face-to-face with these children, six children in total with no mask wearing. We have no ability to social distance. We are bringing them to OT, we're bringing them to the sensory room, and we're dealing with challenging behaviours on a daily basis, which at times SNAs across the country may experience being bit by a pupil. And that's the reality on the ground, and that's why we are asking to be vaccinated, to protect us and to protect the children that we work for.
And how did you feel when you heard that SNAs would no longer be a priority in the vaccine rollout programme?
Yeah, I suppose I speak on myself and behalf of SNAs. It was a smack in the face as opposed to what we were told in February. So when we reopened schools in February, it was with an understanding that SNAs would be vaccinated in the first 30% of the cohort after vulnerable and elderly. And I suppose, just to make it very clear, we don't want to skip the queue. We want to be prioritised after these groups are done, because we are unable to keep social distance from the children that we care for who aren't wearing masks. And the only, I suppose, the only measure that we have is to keep windows open and to wear masks ourselves, which simply isn't good enough. It's what we had in September and it's what we had in December, and nothing has changed since. And I suppose what angered us more was seeing what happened in the Beacon, and if they can get vaccines, well, they can get vaccines for SNAs and education staff and guards and those who need it. Because as Micheál Martin told us, we wore the front line going back to school, and it's very evident that at the moment they don't see us like that, and that's why the vaccine list changed. And it was it's out of sheer frustration that SNAs are having to take themselves to campaign to be vaccinated as a priority.
Thanks to Linda there for talking to us. We can talk now to Andy Pike, who is Forces Head of Education. He's on the line. Andy Pike, no one wants to get COVID, but if you're 20-something or 30-something, the age most SNAs are, I mean, they're 15 times less likely to die from COVID than a 50-year-old who gets it. So why shouldn't the 50-year-old get the priority?
Well, good morning. I don't agree that most SNAs would be in their 20s. We've been representing SNAs for a long period of time. A lot of them came in around the time the statutory scheme was first established and would now be in their 50s or 55 to 60, and there's a cohort nearing retirement to a 60-plus. And one point we've made to NIAC and NEFET is that, can they please explain the logic of a decision that says to a 50-year-old SNA who was due to get a vaccine potentially in May, that they're working in an exposure-prone area, they're at high risk of exposure to COVID-19, and the decision now delays the vaccine for them when they themselves are in a vulnerable group. SNAs in the younger cohort would also say that their worry is, in part, will they contract COVID-19 in the school setting, but also will they bring COVID-19 from the community into the school themselves? They work with very, very vulnerable students who are at risk if they themselves were to contract COVID-19. The other thing that often is overlooked is the reason people become SNAs is very often because they've a personal connection. A lot of SNAs are parents of students with additional needs, and they are very worried about bringing COVID back into the house.
So
it's a complex problem, and I don't think the explanations from government around the rationale for moving to the age-based vaccination schedule answer the issues raised by the unusual and somewhat unique position that special needs assistants find themselves
yes.
in.
But I mean, the rationale is that older people are by their very nature more liable to get COVID and more liable to get very sick and die from COVID. And I suppose, coming back to the vaccinations, if there is enough supply, which the government hopes there will be over the weeks ahead, there won't be any delays, surely. The SNAs will be getting their vaccine just along with thousands of other people over the next few months.
Yes, but the decision means that many thousands of them will now be waiting longer, in some cases many, many weeks longer, to receive the vaccine. And during that period of time, many of them will be working alongside healthcare staff. For instance, in our special schools, where the nurses, physiotherapists and occupational therapists have all been vaccinated under the HSE rollout, yet the SNAs working alongside them day to day will not be vaccinated. That's just not a sustainable situation, that you would vaccinate half of your workforce, but the other half you just ignore.
So what do you expect your members to decide then at their conference on Friday?
Well, they'll give the issue a good airing. There'll be a full discussion. At the moment, we're focused on making the technical arguments about why NIAC and NEFET need to just have another look at this issue for special needs assistance. We wrote to Micheál Martin late last week and copied that correspondence to every member of the Oireachtas, making the point that every SNA feels very let down. We want our schools to stay open, and the issue that our conference will, I think, focus on wouldn't be so much the potential for industrial action, but the potential for absence. If there's an outbreak in a school, the SNA is not in the school, self-isolating or waiting for a clear test result. That has an impact on the student that they care for. These are the issues I think of more concern to our members rather than industrial action at this point. So we've asked the question of the government, can they have a look at this? Will they review it? We're waiting for the answer.
Thank you very much indeed, Andy Pike, Forces Head of Education. And on this Easter Monday morning, it's good morning to Darren Frehill.
Good morning, Audrey. It's one of the biggest days in the race calendar with the running of the Boyle Sports Irish Grand National at Fairy House. 5 o'clock start for the big race. It's live on RTE2 and the RTE Player. The live show begins at 2:30 this afternoon. And we'll talk about that big race in a moment. But first, I just want to reflect on a remarkable story from yesterday's racing at the venue. A horse called Sky Ace won the feature, the Mare's Novice Hurdling. A brilliant win for jockey Jody McGarvey and trainer Shark Hanlon. But this was a fairy tale win for the syndicate which owns the horse. They bought her for £600 in the UK last year. £600, you heard me right. Converted at the time, it was around €705. Well, yesterday, that syndicate won the feature race of the day at Fairy House and picked up a cheque for €60,000. So well done to them. And they can thank their jockey, Jody McGarvey, for steering her home. He won the big race double yesterday and spoke to Mike McCarthy afterwards.
Yeah, look, it was a true run race. They went a good gallop up front. My mare, she jumped super, travelled everywhere whenever I wanted to go. And just when I got her rolling in the straight, she grounded out the whole way to the line. She's hard as nails.
Now, your trainer, Shark, was very, very confident before the race. What were the instructions going out?
Yeah, well, in fairness to him, he leaves it up to me. He doesn't give me any instructions. But he's not one to mince his words. And he was pretty bullish coming here. So, luckily enough, the little mare, she's gone and she's backed it up.
It's a real fairy tale, isn't it? This mare that was sold for, what, €600? And look at it now. She's come of age today.
Yeah, look, it's a great story. She's bought for £600 at the sales, and she's progressed all the way through the ranks, and everyone was doubting her every step of the way. And in fairness to Shark, he believed in her, and she's outdone herself every time. She's really stepped up to the mark in the last year.
Where does she go from here?
I don't actually know. The Shark and the owners make the decisions, I just ride them. But I'd imagine it'll open a lot more doors to her now she's proven at that level, you know.
Yeah, I love a good underdog story on a Monday morning. Well done to everyone concerned there. Today's big race, though, is the Grand National at 5. And during the live show today on RTE2, which gets underway at 2:30, we have a lovely interview with Ruby Walsh coming up that he did with Rachel Blackmore. Rachel rides Robin DiCarlo in that big race. But here's a little flavour from the interview itself with Ruby. She's been talking about getting used to the newfound fame following her heroics at Cheltenham.
I suppose racing is just constantly turning, and you know, there's never an off-season downtime to kind of look back and, you know, take in all your interviews, and, you know, I don't think that happens till you can, you know, retire.
I don't even know if you can do it then. But racing doesn't allow you to, and I'm not expecting you to give me an honest answer, because you can never say, never, racing doesn't allow you to big yourself up. But when you came home on Friday night, yourself and Brian, and you went back to Bagnallstown, did you walk in home and think, wow, what have I achieved?
Yeah, like, it hit me, when I came home and, you know, I suppose when I was in Cheltenham for the 4 days, I wasn't allowing myself to get wrapped up in what was going on at home or the media coverage. As you say, you know, Tuesday was great, but there's Wednesday, and then there's Thursday, and then there's the Gold Cup on Friday. So, and everyone has a different expectation for those days. So you're trying not to get wrapped up with what's going on. But definitely, when I came home on Saturday, it did hit me. You know, this is pretty big. even though it was massive for me personally, but I really did get a sense that it was big for a lot of people, not just me.
So that's Fairy House. There's also racing this afternoon at Cork Racetrack, and the action there gets underway at 10 to 2. Ulster beat Harlequins 57-21 to win a Challenge Cup last 16 game and progress to the quarterfinals. They'll play Northampton next. They ran in 8 tries, but it was against a very weakened Quinn side. They left a lot of younger players, inexperienced players in that team last night, focusing on their domestic competition. So it's just Leinster and Ulster left in Europe now. Leinster will be away to the defending champions Exeter next Saturday. That's at 5:30. And then Ulster will be away to the Saints later that evening. It'll be at 8 o'clock. Sean Reedy was man of the match, and he spoke to BT Sport after it last night.
Obviously, the Pro 14 final was a couple of weeks ago and was pretty gutted missing out on that. So this is another challenge that we can really take with two hands, and the first step was tonight.
How frustrated were you, and are you channeling that into this competition now that you didn't get a chance to go into those playoffs?
Yeah, well, that's all you can do considering the circumstances this year. So we've just got to channel our energy, as you said, positively into these performances, and it started here tonight. So credit to the guys. We put down a pretty dominant platform there, and pretty happy with the result, yeah.
Yeah, they looked excellent last night. I think they've got a big opportunity to win this particular trophy. In soccer, Manchester United tightened their grip on a top four place in the Premier League. A nervy 2-1 win against Brighton. They came from behind to secure the victory. Not at their best at all, but they remain second. They're now 9 points clear of fourth place Chelsea and 11 better off than fifth place Tottenham. So you think at this stage they'd almost have that place in the Champions League for next season. A good weekend for them, but that form last night, was it a concern for their manager Ole Gunnar Solskjaer?
Sometimes after international break, you need some time to get going. The ones who have been here have had a few days off. They've not played for 2 weeks. Some have been away and played a lot of football. So it happens. And football is not a computer game and the robots that just turn it on. The reaction was really good at halftime anyway. As long as we do our job, that's the main thing. Every weekend we have to go in and fight for our lives. You know, everyone talks about teams in the bottom fighting for their lives. We fight for success. We fight to achieve something. We fight for a place in the team. Every player here fights for fights to stay at Man United. And we fight as a team and a group to move up the table and get as many points as possible. So we'll fight every weekend.
Now, Tottenham slipped up 2-2 draw away to Newcastle, wins also for Southampton and Aston Villa. Rangers have drawn Celtic in the fifth round of the Scottish Cup. Stephanie Meadow finished with a brilliant final round of 67 to end the A&A inspiration just inside the top 20. Excellent finish for her at the first major of the year. Leona Maguire, who was in contention at one stage earlier in the week, finished in a tie for 28th place. Paddy Tavatanakit won the title on 18 under par. Jordan Spieth won the Texas Open on the PGA Tour, his first win on the tour for almost 4 years. Graeme McDowell and Padraig Harrington finished down the field. The World Snooker Qualifiers get underway today. Just one Irish player in action today. Leo Fernandez meets Fraser Patrick. And finally, the annual boat race took place yesterday in England between Cambridge and Oxford. And it was Cambridge who recorded a double in the men's and women's races. And I'm mentioning this because one of our listeners got in touch this morning, Patrick, just to tip me off about this because I wasn't aware of it. Hand up, didn't see this one at all. But a special mention to the Cambridge crew because Caoimhe Dempsey was a member of that crew. So winning on the Cambridge team, winning that women's boat race, just looking her up on the Cambridge website, actually. And she gave special mention to her mother, who is a former mountain runner, and she's represented Ireland, and her grandmother who played hockey for Ireland. So it must be in the genes. Well done to Caoimhe and all the crew there.
Darren, thanks a million. Well, Jordan is a country that doesn't usually make global headlines, and that in many ways is its strength. In the turbulence of the Middle East, Jordan has been an ally of the West and a useful intermediary between Israel and the Arab world. And in large part, that stability is down to the Jordanian royal family, originally under King Hussein and then for the past 2 decades under King Abdullah. But that stability is suddenly looking shaky after the government outlined allegations against the king's half-brother, Prince Hamza, that he and others had been involved in an attempted coup, a plot to destabilise the country, Fawaz Girgiz is Professor of Middle East Relations at the London School of Economics. He's on the line now. Fawaz, thanks for joining us. Prince Hamza released a video to the BBC saying that he's under house arrest, that two of his senior aides have been detained. He's denied any allegations of a coup and he turned his finger of blame onto Jordan's rulers. Is this pretty unprecedented?
Well, this is not the Jordan we know. This is very much unusual. These things happen in Syria, in Iraq, in Libya, in Yemen, not in Jordan. Jordan has been relatively a relative oasis in a very turbulent neighborhood. It borders Israel, it borders Iraq, it borders Syria next to Lebanon. So you can imagine why we all tend to celebrate the stability and the security of Jordan. But the past few years have been very difficult for Jordan. For your own listeners, just in the past 4 years since when Donald Trump was in power, Jordan was sidelined in favor of the Saudis and the Emiratis and the Israelis and the Bahrainis. The economic situation has deteriorated a great deal. Last year, 35% of Jordanians were living in poverty. Unemployment is about 30%. Foreign aid has decreased considerably. You have almost 1 million Syrian refugees, a great deal of restiveness among the social base of the Hashemite regime. And on top of that, what we are witnessing, what we have witnessed in the past 48 hours, is a rupture within the Hashemite royal family. I'm not suggesting that King Abdullah II is threatened. That's not the question. But this is the first time that we see a major rift between Hamza, who was the crown prince of Jordan up to 1999 and then 2004, and the King Abdullah II and his allies within the Hashemite family.
Yeah, and we remember a very limited uprising in 2010 when other Arab countries were undergoing similar change. And there's been a tension, perhaps, between Hamza and the royal family. He was crown prince, then he was removed in favour of Abdullah's elder son. And is he more popular as well among a certain portion of the East Bank community? Not Palestinians, not refugees, but the loyal support base that the regime would have?
I mean, I think really you summarized in a very practical way what we are talking about. Hamza was being groomed to become the king. He was the favorite of the late King Hussein. Very charismatic, and suddenly, of course, he was very young when King Hussein died. So he was seen as inexperienced, and he was passed over for the current king, King Abdullah. He is highly popular. He speaks the tribal language, the dialect. The situation has been economically and socially very grim. Great deal of grievances. And Prince Hamza reminds the social base of the Hashemite family, basically of King Hussein. He's really his father. I mean, he looks like his father. He speaks like his father. He's charismatic. So certain key tribes in Jordan have been very unhappy with the situation. There's a tremendous turmoil. I mean, you know, we tend to really be very superficial, all of us, when we talk about Jordan as, you know, an ally of the West. What does it mean? What's happening inside Jordan? The pandemic has done a great deal of damage. So what Prince Hamza does is that he is invited to meet with the tribal leaders, the tribal clans. He listens. He gives voice to the anger going on within. So this is why my take on it, really. You mentioned it's a coup. It's not a coup. Jordan can never have a coup. The security forces and the military, an extension of the palace, he has no connections to the security forces. I think this is a palace coup, forgive me to say that. It's not a coup by Prince Hamza. He cannot carry out a coup, even if he wants to. I think what we are seeing now is a kind of family dispute.
Yeah.
And regardless of the crisis, I think the palace now can really get rid of Prince Hamza once and for all. Because he was seen as a troublemaker, a person who's really willing to meet with the critics of the government and the palace.
We will leave it there for now. We'll keep an eye on it. Thank you very much indeed, Fawaz Gergez, Professor of Middle East Relations at the LSE. We know all too well the impact that the pandemic and Brexit have had on businesses over the past year. But that hasn't stopped people from being creative and entrepreneurial. London-based Irish woman Deirdre McGettrick has founded YouFurnish. It's a website which brings together over 100 furniture retailers so that customers can compare and buy at home. Our London correspondent Sean Whelan reports.
They're getting ready to reopen at Darlings of Chelsea, a furniture retailer headquartered in West London. Shops are back open from April 12th in England. But their expansion plans for the year ahead are all focused on their online presence, according to Chief Operating Officer Tasia Cook.
Darlings of Chelsea really needed to move in that direction and do it quite quickly. So although we've had an online presence pretty much since we started, over the last few years it's been really important to up that presence and actually try and be the sort of forefront runners of some new and interesting ideas online.
But as well as their own website, they've signed up to YouFurnish, an aggregator site for furniture retailers started by Irish woman Deirdre McGettrick and her Australian partner Raymond Wright.
It was literally all inspired by my own frustration trying to furnish my first home. I had all my inspiration from Pinterest, Instagram, cutouts from newspapers and the Argus catalogue back in the day. And I wanted to recreate that, but it became really frustrating to find the furniture. So I wondered, why wasn't there an aggregator? Why wasn't there one place that I can shop across the market, just like you use daft.ie or you use Skyscanner or booking.com for other sectors?
YouFurnish is just over a year old, which means it's a business that was launched in the teeth of some of the least promising circumstances possible, such as the COVID pandemic.
We had an office that we had to let go because you couldn't go into it. We've had to hire all of our team remotely, so we've had Zoom interviews. I still haven't met in person half of the 16 people that we now have working in the business, which is, you know, phenomenal when you think about it. You would never hire somebody that you hadn't met and tried to figure out who that person was, but it's working really well. And actually we're getting great buy-in. People are loving working from home. So you're realizing that you can access a lot of talent that you wouldn't otherwise be able to access because it's not within a certain mile radius of an office. We have people that are working from us in Portugal, all around the UK, and we've just hired our first employee in Ireland.
As retailers have really wanted to digitize their businesses and reach people through online mediums, COVID has accelerated that naturally.
Says Raymond Wright.
What it's forced the retailers to do is probably think laterally and innovate a bit more in the digital sense and look for other outlets and how they can reach in-market consumers. And that's where YouFurnish.com really solves the problem for them as well. And we've been the benefactors, I guess, of that. But that was always the vision for the business even prior to COVID. We could see the industry moving in that direction and that's what we're focused on delivering.
And then, of course, there's Brexit.
There have been massive delays at ports, as it's well publicised. Warehousing space, if you're trying to stockpile, is unavailable. And then you're having to deal with customers who are potentially frustrated by their products not arriving in time after they've ordered them. So there is obviously a knock-on effect because anything that affects our furniture retail partners will affect us. But in terms of our business, because we're online and we're a connector, so we're a search engine rather than the actual delivery of the furniture, we're in one way protected. So then as we look at that, you know, furniture is actually still quite a national business. So most of the retail, I would say over 90% of our retail partners, they just operate in the UK. So when you move into an international market, you will be going out to source new furniture retailers that are specific to that market. And of course, if they are outside of the UK, Brexit will not be a factor for them and they'll be operating as normal.
Back at Darlings of Chelsea, Tasia Cook tells me what she likes about the YouFurnish model.
It's a bit like a state agency. So, you know, they're bringing customers directly to us that are looking for furniture, looking for sofas, looking for sofa beds. It's a great platform in which to drive the right audience that are looking for the products. Advertising in general, you can't necessarily reach the customers that you want or know are in that market. So this is a great platform to use because they are, they're ready, they're wanting to buy.
The online startup has strong Irish investor interest and is chaired by hotel tycoon Pat McCann. Deirdre McGettrick says the plan is to prove the concept in Britain then go further afield.
But we're hoping that by the end of 2021, we'll be putting in place plans to go into our first international market, and that most likely will be Ireland.
Best of luck to her, Deirdre McGettrick, ending that report from London by our correspondent there, Sean Whelan. So are all the eggs eaten? How many did you have? Where's the packaging? Well, Repack is the not-for-profit organisation dedicated to recycling and sustainable waste, and its CEO, Seamus Clancy, joins us now. Seamus, are you expecting that we will generate much waste as a result of Easter?
Good morning, Audrey. Absolutely, I suppose, after Christmas. Easter is the second biggest time of the year. In terms of generating waste and packaging waste in particular. Compound that with COVID and everybody staying at home, and then the volume of Easter eggs that are consumed over Easter, we're expecting roughly the generation of about 49,000 tonnes of packaging waste over the Easter period. That's the equivalent of filling the empty Aviva stadium today. I suppose it's a reflection as well of the whole buying pattern, eating pattern, and drinking habits of consumers in Ireland. They have changed significantly as well because of COVID. We're seeing a huge increase really right across the board, 10% year on year already. And I suppose over the Easter period we see, you know, our survey shows you like 79% of people are still going to celebrate Easter, 50% of those with family. And I suppose what always amazes me is that, you know, 57% people said they'll buy at least 6 Easter eggs. So I don't know how many you bought, Audrey, but some people even buy 10 or more.
Yeah, so well, I didn't buy 10 or more now. I think I bought 2.
But you obviously bought 6 or more, maybe. So, but I think what's really encouraging as well, though, is producers have bought into what's needed as well because of consumer demand and legislation. So we are seeing that, you know, nearly everything in packaging on Easter eggs now is recyclable.
Yeah. Is most of it recyclable?
Yes, most of it is now. You're talking about, particularly, there's a huge amount of cardboard in boxes now. A lot of the plastic has been reduced, and even the plastic that's used is recyclable now in the main. And then all the foil is also, once you crunch it up and put it in your bin, and just, I suppose, we're saying to people all over the country, is to make sure what you put in your recycling bin is clean, dry and loose. Mm.
So is that okay then, Seamus? As long as it's recyclable, does it matter how much packaging there is?
Oh, it does, of course. We have to reduce. You're using resources from all over the world, and that's not sustainable. You know, the consumption levels that we're doing, like in our country, is high. Same throughout Europe, any of the first world countries, if I put it that way. We are consuming too much, and with population growth, we actually have to look to reduce and to recycle more and to keep it within the circular economy. Good example, I suppose, you take glass for last year, like, we're probably number one in Europe now in terms of glass. We recycled 87% of it. But last year alone, glass increased by 14%. And that's really a reflection of consumer behaviour as well in terms of our drinking habits at home.
Yeah.
Overall, packaging has remained fairly stable because it's moved from the hospitality sector into the home, which is very tough in the hospitality sector. But in the main, Irish people have really embraced recycling. We want people to encourage them to do more of that.
To do more. Seamus, we leave it there. We're out of time, but thank you very much. Seamus Clancy, CEO of Repack.